abruptly. I've got to go back. I can't leave her to face that alone. That's just what you can't do, he said, jumping up and catching hold of both her arms. Don't you see? If you did that, you'd just be confirming the idea in people's heads. Besides, you've been given an assignment and a set of orders. It's not up to you to decide whether or not you're going to obey them. She buried her face in her hands for a moment. When she took her hands away, he could see her fighting to exert control over herself. All right, she said, sinking back to the ground. You're right. You said that there were other rumors. What are they?
That you've been using your gift to influence other people, specifically counselors, on crucial votes. The kindest version of that rumor says that you're not doing it consciously, that you don't realize you're doing it.
Good God! How am I supposed to answer that one?
Chris didn't have an adequate reply, so he continued. Another rumor is that you're using your gift just to read people, then using the knowledge of their emotional state to manipulate them into doing what you want.
Goddess, that's almost close to the truth.
Again, the kindest version is that you don't realize that you're doing it. People are frightened. Your gift isn't one they've seen outside of a healer. Mind speakers have an ethical code they understand, but this?
So far as I know, there is no ethical code, she said, and looked up at him.
Her eyes were full of a pain he didn't understand, and a confusion he wished he could resolve.
Is that all?
Isn't it enough? They say you're young, you're inexperienced, some say too young to be in the position of power that you are, and to be wielding such a strange mind gift.
As if, she replied bitterly, I have any choice in the matter.
And she did not speak to him again until long after they had mounted up and gotten back on the North Road. Chris bore with her lack of communication up to a point, but finally decided to try and break the deadlock himself. He mind-touched Tantris, asking him to move in closer to Roland until he and Talia were almost knee-to-knee.
"Just exactly how does your gift work?" he asked, unwilling to bear the tense silence.
"I feel emotions the way far speakers hear words," she replied, after turning in her saddle to give him a sober look, one that seemed to be weighing him for some quality. If the emotions are connected with something strongly enough, I see that. If they're twisted or wrong, or very negative, sometimes I can fix them, like a healer with a wound. Ilsa said it's a pretty rare gift to see crop up alone, that it's usually tied up with the healing gifts, as you know.
Interesting, he replied as casually as he could. So that's how you were able to lead me to where Ilsa died. Most heralds are mind-speakers, you know, and most of the rest are farseers, like me. Only a few of us have odd gifts, like yours and Dirk's, and Griffin's. Brr, that's one I wouldn't want.
The sun lost some of its warmth for him as he thought of the demonstration Griffin and Dirk had given him.
Fire-starting is a terrible burden. And it's so easy for the power to get out of control, and when it does, well, you end up with barrens like at Burning Pines. And it isn't really useful at all, except as a weapon. I hope his being born with it now doesn't mean something. Heralds with the really odd gifts tend to appear when there's going to be a need for them. The last Firestarter was Levan Firestorm, and you know what his era was like.
He flushed, beginning to realize that he was pontificating, but damn, he wanted to get her mind off the rumors, so she'd act normally again.
Sorry, I tend to get carried away when I start discussing gifts. It's a hobby of mine, one I share with Kirill. It's fascinating to see what kinds of gifts we have and to try and see if there are patterns.
Really?
She perked up a little, a bit more color coming into her cheeks.
Has anybody else ever had my kind of gift before?
Not that I'm aware of among the heralds, but I must admit that I've only looked into the gifts of living heralds, or the really spectacular ones of the past. I can't say that I've ever heard of that ability to heal the mind, except in a true healer, but it wouldn't surprise me much to discover that this one's the gift that distinguishes the Queen's Own from the rest of us, and you seem to have it mostly by itself, and maybe much stronger even than inhalers. Probably the others have had it, but not so strongly that anyone noticed it. Nobody seems to have made a study of the monarch's own, not like they have with the more ordinary gifts. And now that I think about it, your primary job is to ensure the mental stability of the monarch. An ability, like the one you have, could come in very useful if something really went wrong.
He was doing his best to imply that he believed her, that he was certain the rumors weren't true. He only wished that he really could be that certain.
I can see that.
She was silent and seemed to be thinking hard. Late afternoon sun was gilding everything and the early breeze had died. The Chura's eyes were half closed in the drowsy warmth, and the few sounds to either side of them were those of farm workers cutting hay and grain, and insects droning in the grass.
So, you see and Dirk fetcheth.
Right. That's why we work together, and generally don't ride sectors, except when we're short-handed, the way we have been lately. To put it bluntly, we're Selene's thieves.
He laughed a little.
If I know what I'm looking for, I can generally find where it is from several miles away. More if I get a ride, like I got from you. Once I know exactly where it is and can fix the location in my mind, Dirk can read the location to fetch whatever it is where we happen to be. That's how he retrieved Ilse's arrows.
That seems to be a lot harder than it sounds. Rather wear and tear from the little I've seen.
Gods, that's an understatement. In a lot of ways, it would be less tiring to run on foot to where it is, get it, and run back. And the heavier the object, the more difficult it is to fetch. We haven't tried anything much larger than a building brick. And that gave him a reaction headache that lasted for a week. I was pretty surprised when he had enough energy left to carry you to your room after retrieving those arrows.
Uh-huh. She seemed pleased that it had been Dirk who had cared for her. A mystery solved. I've wondered about that for the last 2 years. So he was the one.
He was like a hen with one chick, wouldn't let me do more than trail along, and I was in better shape than he. Said that with all those girls in his family, he knew better than I did what to do with a sick one.
Can he work with anyone but you?
We don't know. He's never tried, since he gets such a good fix from me. Probably, though. One farseer's a lot like another.
How long have you two been working together?
She asked curiously.
Since we both got our whites. That was another year they were short-handed and sent us both out to intern with the same counselor, Jerick. Well, you know Jerick. He's absent-minded. He left a small but valuable ring at one of the way stations. It was the Queen's gift to one of the guildmasters. Rather than spend 2 hours going back for it, Dirk offered to try fetching it. I looked for it, found it had rolled under the bed while we were packing, and gave Dirk the location. That was when we discovered that I gave him the clearest fix he'd ever had to work from. He fetched the ring, no problem. We started working as a team, and we've been doing things that way ever since.
It's just that you seem so unlike each other. I find it hard to imagine you two staying together.
Chris laughed, pleased to have gotten onto a safe subject.
You might be surprised. Underneath that jester mask he wears, Dirk's a very serious gentleman. And we have pretty much the same taste in music, reading, even food.
And women, she teased.
Well, that, too, he admitted with a reluctant smile. And it's really pretty unfair. Poor Dirk. It doesn't matter if he finds the lady first. Once she's seen me, she usually goes all sisterly on him. He's mostly pretty good-natured about it, but if I were in his shoes, I'd be damned annoyed.
Well, he knows you can't help it. You were born looking like an angel, and he... Well, he wasn't, and that's all there is to say.
It's still not fair. You'd think that at least one woman would figure out that Dirk the man is worth 10 faces like mine.
I expect someday someone will, Talia replied noncommittally, avoiding his eyes. Where is he from?
Her reply was just a bit too casual. Her attempt at nonchalance immediately set off mental alerts in Chris's mind, especially following all those questions about his partner. Part of him followed up on the puzzle while he answered her question. He had a very faint suspicion, too tenuous to be even a guess. It was rather like trying to remember a name he'd forgotten. It would probably take a while before he had enough information to make a surmise, but now he'd be subconsciously watching for clues.
The sector right next to ours, Sorrows One. He's got a huge family up there. He used to haul me home with him for the holidays, still does when we're free.
Three of his married sisters and their families live with their parents and help run the farm. It's like a madhouse. People everywhere, babies and cats constantly underfoot. It's marvelous madness, though. They're wonderful people, and there's never a lonely or dull moment.
He smiled half to himself as he recalled some of those visits, his earlier thoughts gone on the breeze.
Dirk's family, they should have been gypsies, all of them crazy and all of them delightful. He'd been looking forward to another midwinter festival with them, but it obviously wasn't going to be this year. Well, there was always another time.
Talia's next question broke the strange, apprehensive chill he felt at that thought.
What about you?
Well, let me think. My father is Lord Peregrine. I'm the second son, but my brother is 10 years older than I am, and I have nephews and nieces that aren't much younger than you. My parents are both very wrapped up in matters of state, so I was left pretty much in the hands of my tutors back on the family estate.
I think I know your father. He's one of the Seneschal's chief assistants. And your mother?
She organizes the resupply of the way stations. I think she would have liked to have been a herald, but since she wasn't chosen, this is the closest she can get.
Weren't there any children your own age on the estate?
Not many. Their parents seemed to think mine would be angry if their offspring were allowed to contaminate me. I spent a great deal of my time reading.
Like me, only you didn't have to hide to do it, she laughed.
You're wrong there. My tutors seemed to think that my every waking moment should be spent learning something serious, dull, and practical. I had a hiding place up in the oldest tree in the garden. I fixed it up until it was quite impossible to see me from the ground. I smuggled my tales and poetry up there and escaped at every opportunity.
A breeze that stirred the leaves of the trees lining the road to either side of them seemed to chuckle at Chris's childish escapes.
Then, when I was 12, my parents took me to court. I don't think it ever entered their heads that the collegium stood on the same grounds.
He smiled.
Even if they'd forgotten, though, I hadn't. I hoped. But when no companion met me at the palace gate, I gave the dream up. I was supposed to be presented at Vernal Equinox Festival, and I can remember everything, right down to the fact that one of my bootlacings didn't quite match the other. I was standing next to my father outside in the gardens, you know, when there was an unexpected visitor to the festivities.
Tantris shook his head, making the bells on his bridle sing. Chris chuckled and reached forward to scratch behind his ears.
I knew what the appearance of a companion meant, and I kept looking around to see who he had come to choose. I nearly went out of my mind with happiness when I finally stopped craning my head around and found he was standing right in front of me. Then, when I looked into his eyes, his voice trailed off.
"It's not like anything else, is it?" Talia prompted softly. "And it isn't something you ever lose the wonder of."
"That it's not," he agreed, speaking half to himself.
"And I knew then that I'd never be lonely again." He shook off the spell and became matter-of-fact.
"Well, my parents were both very proud. They had me installed at the collegium before I had a chance to turn around. Oddly enough, it's easier to deal with them now that I'm an adult. My father can relate to me as an equal, and I think that my mother forgets half the time that I'm one of her offspring. I really don't think they ever knew what to do with a child."
"They probably didn't, especially with so much time between you and your brother."
"Dirk has no notion how much I envy him his family," he sighed.
"You think not?" Talia smiled. "Then why does he keep bringing you home with him?"
"I never thought about that."
They rode silently for a mile or so.
"Talia, do you ever miss your family?"
"Not after I found other people who really cared about me. I was the Scarlet G among the crows with them. I was more of an outsider among my own family than I ever was at the collegium. One of those pretty brothers of mine used to steal my books and call me Herald Talia to make me cry. I'd like to have seen his face when I was chosen."
"Do you ever think about going back?"
"You know,
That used to be a daydream of mine, that I'd somehow magically become a herald. Remember, I didn't know about being chosen, and I'd come back dressed in my whites and covered in glory. Then they'd all be envious and sorry that they were mean to me. And now? Well, I went back long enough to try and rescue the sister I'd been closest to, only to find she had turned into a stranger. I didn't go any farther into the holdings, just turned around and came back home. I didn't want to see any of them again. Why bother? My parents pretended I was an outsider. My sibs were either afraid or contemptuous. Herald's are very immoral, you know. What is it Miro's book says about how the people you grow up with react to your fame?
No one honours a saint on his hearthstone.
It's true, too. I'm resigned to letting things rest as they are, knowing that my example shows misfits that there is an escape.
He didn't seem inclined to further conversation, so she turned her attention back to those unsettling rumours. Poisonous, that's what they were. Ugly and poisonous.
And true? Said a niggling little doubt.
She wanted to deny any truth to it all vehemently, but could she? In all conscience, could she? The business about Elspeth, no, she could not believe she'd been fostering dependence in the child, not even unconsciously. Once Elspeth had begun acting like a human being again, she'd been pushing her toward independence, driving her to make her own decisions and take responsibility for the results. But the rest, oh, insidious. For a mind speaker, it was obvious when he was projecting. It sounded to the recipient a great deal like the mind speaker's normal voice, but as if the words were coming from deep inside his own ear. But when she projected, would anyone be able to tell she was doing so? She could tell. Sending emotion cost her effort and energy. But if she were excited or agitated, would she notice the energy expense? Did she even need to be doing it while she was awake? What about when she was asleep? How could she possibly be sure what her irrational sleeping mind was doing? And what about simply reading people's emotional states? Was she transgressing by doing so and acting on the knowledge? How could she avoid doing it? It was like seeing color. It was just there unless someone was deliberately shielding. Doubt followed doubt in an insidious circle, each feeding on the one preceding it until Chris broke the silence.
This is our first stop. This close to the capital, they won't be hungry for news, and it's very unlikely they'd need us to work in any official capacity. Still, it's only good manners to repay them in some way for their hospitality. Small villages don't see trained bards oftener than once a month, so they're very receptive to even amateur music. Would you be willing to sing if I played?
Of course, she replied, grateful for the interruption. It's only fair that I share the work. Did you notice that I brought my lady?
No! He exclaimed with delight. You'll let me play her? I have a small travelling harp with me, but it isn't half the range or the tone of my lady.
I let you have her the other night, didn't I? You'll have to retune her. I detuned the strings so they wouldn't snap if the weather changed suddenly. She smiled shyly. I have good instrument etiquette. Jade has taught me quite well, I assure you.
He couldn't do otherwise when it came to music. He's the one who taught me in the first place.
Really? I wonder why he didn't leave her to you.
That's easy enough to answer. I didn't take the time to keep him company the way you did.
Chris replied, with a slightly shamed expression.
He may have given me a little of his skill, but he gave his harp where he'd given his heart, to a lonely little girl, because she'd given him her own.
The village came into view before a surprised Talia had time to form a reply. Children swarmed upon them, chattering and calling questions that both heralds fielded with chuckles and smiles. Older children ran ahead to alert their elders that there were two heralds taking the road north, who were clearly planning on spending the night. Long before they reached the inn at the center of the village square, a crowd had gathered to meet them. The village itself was a large one, with cobblestone streets and white-plastered buildings of two and even three stories high. Rather than thatched, the roofs were tiled, something Talia had read was more common the farther north one went. With all the shutters thrown open, soft yellow light gleamed through the windows of the houses as the sun set and candles and lamps were lit. As Chris had indicated, this village was close enough to the capital that heralds stopped with fair regularity. Heralds traveling to their sectors were housed in inns rather than the way stations, unless they were caught without other shelter, and inns got back a percentage of their taxes for every herald they entertained. It was possible for an inn on a busy road to be rebated all of its tax if enough heralds stayed there, and that made heralds welcomed and sought-after guests. Under all those strange eyes, Talia regained an outward control at least, putting on her public face and pushing her self-doubts to the back of her mind. It would not do for these people to see her disturbed. The innmaster himself welcomed them at his front step and escorted them to the stables. Stable hands tended to the churras, but the heralds themselves cared for their companions. Chris chuckled once or twice, apparently at something that Tantris said to him, and Talia felt a tiny twinge of jealousy at their ability to mind-speak one another. Once back inside, the innmaster escorted them personally to their quarters, and gave Talia and Chris small rooms on the second floor, rooms scrupulously, almost painfully clean. Their rooms adjoined one another, and each boasted a window, a small table, and a narrow bed that looked surprisingly comfortable. They were courteously given the use of the bathhouse without anyone pestering them. But once they joined the rest of the guests in the common room for supper, the questions began. The dark-paneled common room overflowed to near bursting with villagers. Tallow dips and sconces on the walls cast a dim but clear light, so it was easy to see and be seen. The air was seasoned with a pleasant aroma of bread and roasting meat and wood smoke. Though the furnishings were only rough wooden tables and benches, they and the floor were sanded smooth and scrubbed clean. The heralds took their places at a table near the fire, and the rest of the guests gathered around them. Chris took it upon himself to try and answer them, but when it seemed as if he'd never get more than a mouthful of dinner before it got cold, Talia took her own turn. As Chris had told her, the common people were very well informed, this close to the capital. What they wanted most was detail. Much of what they wanted to know centered on the new heir, a subject Talia knew very well indeed. She satisfied them enough that eventually she and Chris were able to finish their dinners in peace. Talia had brought my lady down with her. While Chris tuned her, she took the time to answer questions from a different source, the children. They seemed to sense that this herald would not brush them off, ignore them, or give them light answers. They had 1,000 questions concerning heralds and what it took to be one. Some of the questions gave her pause for thought.
"Why don't heralds ever stay in one place?" one young boy asked. "We always have the same priest. Why don't we keep the same herald?"
"For one thing, there just aren't enough of us to send one to each village, or even one to each group of villages," Talia told him. "For another, tell me, what will happen when your priest grows old and retires, or perhaps dies?"
"They'll send us a new one, of course,
and he'll be a stranger to all of you. Do you think he'll fit in and be accepted right away?"
"No," the lad grinned impudently. "A lot of the grannies won't really trust him until he's been here for years, if then."
"But a herald has to have your trust right away, don't you see? If you come to trust the person more than the office, the way you do with your priest, there would be trouble for every new herald in a sector."
The boy looked thoughtful at this.
"So you move all the time to make sure it's the job that stays important, not the person doing it? I bet if you stayed in one place too long, you'd get too bound up with the people to judge right, too."
A little startled by this observation, so very accurate, she sent a fleeting thought toward the stable. Since she wasn't in trance, Roland couldn't give her more than a vague feeling, but the impression was that he had already noted this boy, and it was very probable that the child was going to receive a hoofed visitor in the next year or two. Armed with this knowledge, she answered the rest of this boy's questions with special care and watched him afterward. She noted that he seemed to be the mentor and protector of some of the little children, urging them forward to talk to her when he knew that they were too shy to go alone. He wasn't above his share of pranking about, she noticed with relief, but his tricks were never those that could hurt anyone. Chris soon had the harp in tune. Talia let him take center stage alone for a while, knowing how much the approving attention would please him. The guests and villagers were loud in their appreciation, and only when Chris was glowing from their applause did Talia add her voice to the harp song. The host of the inn eventually decreed they'd tired the heralds out long enough and mock-ordered both of them to their beds. Talia was just as pleased. She was feeling the effects of a long day in the saddle, and she thought of her pillow and warm bed with longing. When they mounted the next morning, just as the sun arose, Talia winced a little as she climbed into her saddle. "So?" Chris asked with a slight smile. She groaned faintly.
"Before this trip is over, I'll probably be in agony. I didn't realize I was this badly out of riding trim. I may never be able to get my legs closed again."
"That would make some people happy,"
he teased, and ducked as she threw an apple core left from her breakfast at him.
"Just for that, maybe I won't give you this."
He held up a pouch that jingled faintly. "Why? What is it?" she asked, curiosity aroused.
"When I picked up our expense money, I thought perhaps you might have forgotten your stipend," he replied, tossing the pouch over to her. "You had, so I drew it for you. You're a full herald now, remember? You earn a stipend."
"But I hate havens."
Her hand flew to her head in embarrassment.
"I did forget."
"Don't feel badly. After 5 years of no pocket money, most of us forget. I did.
But it comes in very handy, especially when you happen to be at a fair and see something you just know so-and-so would love, or for that matter, that you can't live without."
"It's a good thing I've got you for a counselor," she replied ruefully. "I'd probably have left my own head back at the Collegium." Chris just chuckled as he led the way out the gates of the inn onto the road. As they traveled northward, the road changed from the strange gray material to packed gravel, to clay, to finally a simple, raised and cleared strip between the trees, all the grass worn down by travelers and their mounts and carts. As the roadway changed, so did the landscape to either side. Farms covered more area, and there were greater stretches of uncultivated land between them, from wide meadows to nearly virgin forest. The weather changed, growing slowly but steadily worse. It rained almost every day, in a steady, penetrating shower. And soon the rains lasted all day, never becoming less than a drippy drizzle, so that the chill water soaked through even their oiled wool cloaks. The Churas whined in protest at being made to travel at all, and they rode enveloped in miasmas of soggy leaves and wet wool. By the time they reached their chosen resting place each night, they were aching with cold, sodden clear through, and longing for hot wine, hot food, and hotter baths. Talia's mood was at one with the weather. Her mind kept running in circles on the same subject. Was she misusing her gift? How could she tell? What were the ethics of empathic sensing anyway? From time to time, long skeins of waterbirds called from overhead, flying south high and fast, their cries coming down on the wind like the calls of lonely spirits. The lost calls echoed in Talia's mind long after they'd passed. Sad callings for the answers to questions that could not be answered. And when, at dismal day's end, they saw the lights of the next village and heard the cheerful noise of the inn, those were welcome sights and sounds indeed. And yet for Talia, the sight of the inn became a prospect she almost dreaded. She found herself scanning the faces of those around her, seeking almost obsessively for some sign that she was influencing their moods. The only interruption to her rounds of intense self-scrutiny came when Chris drilled her in the intricacies of the arrow code, or coaxed her into some kind of conversation while they rode. The farther north they went, the farther apart the villages were. Finally, there was little choice as to which village they would rest in overnight. Often there would be only one within striking distance. The cultivated areas began to be fewer, the woods and forests thicker and showing less evidence of the hand of man. At long last, the weather cleared a bit. The rain stopped, although most days were overcast. At the beginning of the trip, the workers they saw in the fields had hailed them cheerfully, then gotten on with what they were doing.
Now, almost invariably, the farm folk called them to the roadside and offered them a drink of sweet cider or cold spring water in exchange for a bit of news. This evidence alone made it plain that they were on the very edge of the kingdom. For at this time of year, there wasn't much time left to get the last of the crops in. And it took a great deal to pull a farmer's attention away from that goal, even for the little time it took to drink a glass and pass a trifle of information. Talia was just as glad that they met with so few people. Her circling self-doubts were beginning to have an effect on her. Her shields were wearing thin, and she could feel the press of Chris's emotional state just beyond them, though he was trained to mind-block without thinking about it. With ordinary folk, it was far worse. It didn't help her doubts at all that to sense that he was still uneasy about her. Chris had done his best to shove his uncle's words into the back of his mind, but he wasn't overly successful. He wanted to bring up the subject with Talia again, but hadn't dared. She seemed edgy and preoccupied in general, and nervous whenever they were around large groups of people, although he doubted that anyone but another herald would have noticed the nerves behind her public face. So he tried to keep the conversation going on other topics. But behind it all were the unanswered questions. Was she misusing her gift? Was she doing so without realizing it? And, much more sobering, was she using it to manipulate him? It was distressing because he was coming to like her a great deal, more so even than the usual hail-fellow-good comradeship that was the norm among heralds. They were very much alike in many ways. It was horrible to have to suspect a friend of something so insidious. Because she was becoming that, a friend of the same order as Dirk. "You know," he said one day out of the blue, "you're like the sister I never had."
"You're like the brother I wish I had," she replied without seeming to think about it, "that I might have had if Andrian hadn't died in that raid. He was the only one of my sibs who was kind to me, excepting Rissa. If I'd had you instead of Eustace and Keltiv, things might have been easier."
"They also might have turned out a lot differently. Would you have been willing to run away if life had been more pleasant?"
"A good point," she conceded. "Probably not. And then where would I be?" He grinned, while Tantris shook his head mirthfully and made his bridal bells ring.
"If what you've told me is true, 6 years married and the mother of as many children."
She grimaced and shifted in the saddle with a creak of leather. "Thank you, no. Hectic as it is, I like the life I'm leading now. Speaking of which, don't we cross into our new sector today?"
He pulled the map they'd been given out of a pocket on the front of his saddle, consulted it, and peered around the lowering sky, looking for landmarks. Finally, he spotted one, a cluster of 3 flat-topped hills off to the west of the road.
"We'll cross the border before nightfall, and we'll be staying tonight at our first way station."
"Because," she put on a somber mien, "heralds do not stay at inns in the sector they serve, unless weather prevents them from reaching a station. This ensures that they keep a proper distance and maintain impartiality with the people of their sector." "I remember."
"You certainly do," he laughed,
cheered by her apparent return to good humor.
"That's old Verda to the life."
"And that's also the reason we either buy the supplies we run out of outright or wait until we reach a resupply station, assuming they're not in the way station. Right?"
"Hi, Marx. Completely correct."
He looked about him at the falling leaves, at trees whose branches were almost bare.
"I'm sorry that this isn't going to be an easy beginning for you. This is a bad time of year to start riding this sector. There's going to be snow in the next couple of weeks. Trainees usually aren't faced with conditions this hard at the beginning of their internships."
"I'm border bred, remember? This is a lot more like the kind of life I was bred to than my life at the Collegium. I'll manage."
"You know," he said soberly, "I know you'll do your best. I know you'll try your hardest. That's all anyone can ask. I trust you, Talia."
At least, he thought to himself,
"I think I do."
Chapter 5. The boughs of the nearly leafless trees arched above them, skeletal hands reaching for the gray sky. The road continued before them, a leaf-carpeted tunnel through the bleak, gray-brown forest. The sodden leaves had been flattened by so many rains that the companions didn't even kick them up. The dense mat only served to muffle the sounds of their hooves. There were no birds, only the occasional sound of a branch cracking somewhere off in the shadows of the underbrush. Talia and Chris rode well past sunset and on into the dark to reach the way station Chris intended to use as their first stop in their new sector. With the last rays of the sun went the last hint of warmth. As the last dim red light filtered through the branches, a cold wind began to sigh among them. Chris took the lead, but it was Tantris, with the superior night sight of companions, who was really picking out their way. Through cold and dark, that was enough to drive just about any other consideration from human minds. Talia was strongly considering unpacking her heavy cloak, and was definitely glad that all way stations, however small or primitive, had fireplaces. The wind had a sharp bite to it, and carried a hint of snow along with the cold. This station, as it loomed up out of the shadows in front of them, did not appear to be all that small. Hopefully, it was not primitive either. One thing was always the first order of business, no matter how late the hour, nor how foul the weather, when heralds opened a way station. Talia dismounted, felt along Roland's saddle, and took out her fire starter and tinderbox. After no little fumbling and cursing, she managed to get a tiny flame going in the tinder. Protecting it carefully from the wind, she removed a small fibrous bundle from one of the packs. It had a waxed wick sticking out of it, which she lit at the tiny flame. While Chris pulled off the packs and saddlebags, she tossed it inside and shut the door. He left the packs at her feet and took companions and Chiras around to the side of the building. While she waited, she shivered in the cold wind and started a little when an owl cried in the distance. The little, homely sounds Chris was making in the lean-to stable were very welcome against all that dark, with the wind sighing in the boughs of the trees. She nursed the tiny fire she had going. If it went out, the whole rigmarole was to do over again. When she had counted to 100, slowly, she opened the door again. The station was full of a pungent, oily smoke that was now being swiftly drawn up the chimney with the help of the draft from the open door, and any vermin that had been within the station were either dead or fled. Talia hauled the packs and bedrolls inside, then began to get them set up while Chris ducked inside long enough to get grain for the companions and the Chiras, who were now in the stabling at the side of the building. She took a rushlight from her saddlebag by feel and lit it from her bit of tinder. To her immense relief, the place seemed to be quite sturdy and well-maintained and supplied. She threw the bedrolls into the twin bed boxes, then proceeded, wistfully wishing for just a touch of Griffin's gift, to get a fire going. It took several false starts, but eventually she managed to get a respectable blaze on the cold hearth. Once the flames were high enough to provide illumination as well as warmth, she extinguished the light she'd lit. No sense in wasting what wasn't really necessary, and the rushlights took up so much space in the packs that they didn't carry many of them. She unpacked some of their food supplies and unsealed the vermin-proof sandalwood bins the station staples were kept in to put together a reasonable meal, then took two of the larger pots outside to the well to get water for washing and cooking. Chris seemed to be taking overly long with bedding down the Churras and companions. She'd managed to heat enough water for both of them to wash, had fixed a meal, and had cleaned herself up and changed into a worn shift and old breeches she kept for sleeping in before he finally appeared. She was about to chide him for being so slow when she realized that he dawdled on purpose.
"Chris, you don't have to be so thrice-blessed chivalrous, you know," she said instead,
feeling his reticence sharply and being irrationally irritated by it.
"All the children on the Holden sleep in the same room until they're 13, and you know very well I've shared way stations and tents with my whole year group while we were in training. I can't possibly have something you've never seen before, and the same goes for you."
"I'm just not used to having a woman as a partner," he said.
Then stop thinking of me as a woman.
She yawned, bundling herself into her bedroll and blinking at him sleepily through the firelight. Her irritation was gone as quickly as it had come, once she'd reinforced her shielding. Although the fact that she'd had to do the latter bothered her. She shouldn't have needed to.
That's easy for you to say, he retorted.
Then pretend I'm Karen, with no interest in men whatsoever. Because if you don't, one of these evenings I'm going to find an ice statue waiting outside the door, and it'll be you.
He chuckled and admitted that she just might be right. Her heart pounded a little the next day as they approached their first village of their sector. There was no telling what reception awaited them or what requests. This far from the capital, a village often didn't even boast its own priest but shared one with several other villages, and the only representatives of kingdom law were the heralds. Her shields were so very thin. She'd discovered that last night. She couldn't fathom why. Shielding had always been second nature, nearly instinctive, and now they seemed to be eroding, slowly, inexorably. She was frightened by the loss of control and was afraid to tell Chris, afraid her confession would simply reinforce his own doubts about her and create more stress than she already had. As they rode in, it appeared as though the entire population of the area had assembled to meet them. Talia thought they must have had lookouts posted, perhaps for the last week or so, waiting for the heralds they knew were replacing the injured one. The emotional atmosphere, which she felt in spite of her best efforts to shield, was tense, with no hint of why. The village was a small one, single-storied houses of gray wood and darker gray stone, topped with tile roofs, all clustered about a central square. There were no bright painted shutters here. The wind-driven ice of winter storms would have etched the paint off in a single season. The inn was so small it obviously had no guest rooms. Those overnighting would have to sleep in the common room on the benches when the inn closed for the night. There was no sign of damage to any of the buildings, no hint of disorder. Whatever had these folk anxious had nothing to do with their material life. The village folk, though, they were dressed in gaudy colors as if for a festival. So why the feeling of apprehension so thick she could almost smell it?
"Thanks be to the lady, you finally come!"
A plump woman who reminded Talia for all the world of a hen bustled forward, pushing before her a young couple of about 16 or so, until they stood less than a foot from Chris's stirrup. Both were dressed in heavily embroidered finery, and the girl was roundly pregnant. They clutched each other's hands as if they were afraid, and neither of them would look at the heralds. Talia was puzzled beyond her own worries. What was it that could be wrong, that she hadn't sensed?
"The priest took sick and hasn't been able to make his round since 8 weeks ago," continued the plump woman, tucking a stray strand of hair behind the girl's ear. "And in any case, he hasn't been here since before Midsummer. There hasn't been anyone to marry these two in all that time."
"Were they properly year and day handfasted?" Talia asked, knowing the border custom meant to ensure fertility before a permanent bond was made.
"Bright stars, yes, the priest did it himself last midwinter,"
the woman exclaimed impatiently, while the other villagers nodded in agreement. Enlightenment dawned on Talia, though Chris was obviously still perplexed about the reason for their obvious apprehension.
"You're both still willing?"
he asked. Both gave a very shy assent, but one obviously unforced.
"They're just victims of very bad timing," Talia whispered to him. "And they're afraid we'll disapprove, maybe even refuse to wed them, because they left the formal ceremony so long. They should have wedded as soon as they knew she was with child. But I'll bet a pretty they were so busy with planting that they put it off until after Midsummer, assuming the priest would get here in plenty of time, except that they hadn't counted on him falling ill. Poor babies. They're terribly in awe of us, and they're afraid we'll make difficulties for them because they didn't take care of it right away. We'd be within our right to do so by the letter of the law."
"But not by the spirit,"
Chris whispered back, relieved that it was so simple.
"Well, since everyone's agreed,"
he said loudly enough for everyone to hear, smiling broadly, "what's holding up the celebration?" There was a general sigh of tension vanishing, and trestle tables and food began appearing as if conjured by a spell.
Before very long, the square had been transformed, and a proper wedding celebration was in full swing. To save them any further embarrassment, Chris took the young couple off to one side and witnessed their vows, signing their wedding contract as officiating herald in lieu of a priest. The young couple returned to enjoy their feast, their shyness nearly gone. They were obviously comforted on two counts: that the heralds had made no difficulty over the lateness of their vows, and that now their firstborn would have no taint of illegitimacy about it. The remainder of that day they spent in relative idleness, since there was no use whatsoever in trying to get any official business conducted. The press of people was putting a considerable strain on Talia, but she thought she was succeeding in keeping the strain from showing, even to Chris. She sat mostly on the edge of things, speaking pleasantly when spoken to, but letting Chris take the lion's share of the attention. And she was even more worried than when they'd first entered this village. Her shields hadn't been this fragile since before she'd learned the full use of her gift. Virtually anything would bring them down, and she had to expend ridiculous amounts of energy to put them back up again. If only she'd never heard those filthy rumors. The thought of the rumors brought her back full circle to her self-doubt and fear, and the press of emotions became almost painful, until she finally resorted to an old expedient, drinking enough wine to blur the edges of her sensing and make it all bearable. It was rather too bad that it left her sober enough to negotiate the dark path back to the way station with no trouble at all, for that meant she was still sober enough to think. They returned the next day, ready for business. The people of the village had no grievances that needed settling, but they were eager to hear the news from the capital and the other towns of the sector. The common room of the inn, dark and smoky as it was the only public room in the whole village, so that was where they conducted their business. The village storyteller, who doubled as the clerk, sat drinking in every word they spoke, and making copious notes, for it would be his duty to repeat all that the heralds related for those who were absent from the village, or for those smallholders who seldom came to town. They gave the morning to the decisions of the queen and council, how and why those decisions had been reached, and what, if any, laws had been passed to uphold and enforce those decisions, and the afternoon they spent relating the news of the court and events of major importance to the entire kingdom, all of which took them until darkness fell, and they returned to the station again. This day had lain easier on Talia's wire-taut nerves, for there was nothing to excite anyone's emotions in the dry news they recited. And even if there had been, the storyteller clerk was too intent on memorizing every word to allow his feelings to intrude. When the two of them returned to the way station, Talia made herself a cup of double-strength chamomile tea, a strong soporific. She was determined to get to sleep, and to sleep deeply, thinking perhaps weariness was part of the cause of her troubles. But her dreams were uneasy, and she woke feeling more drained than she had been when she'd gone to sleep. They spent the third day on the reports of the headman and clerk, and taking the verbal news of the village to be passed on up the line. Chris would carry the headman's written reports until they came to a center of population large enough to boast a messenger, or until they arrived at a resupply station, at which point he could send what he had collected south to the capital, together with his own observations on the probable truth or falsehood of the information contained in them. That was Chris's job. Talia remained in the background the entire time, hoping to be noticed as little as possible, for it seemed that the strain was worst when she was interacting with someone. But that evening at the way station, Chris insisted on hearing Talia's opinion on the reports they'd been given and the reliability of the headman and clerk who had given them. "They seemed honest to me," she told him, hoping he had had no notion of how much she had sensed against her will. "I didn't have any feeling they were trying to mislead us, hide anything, or hold anything back. As far as I can judge, the only mistakes in their records are honest errors. They were quick enough to correct them in any event when you pointed them out." "Good," Chris said with satisfaction. "That tallies with what I saw. I'm just as glad. I hate calling people out, even when it's blatantly obvious that they're lying to me."
He noted both their observations on the cover page of the reports and sealed them in a waterproof wrapper. To Talia's relief, he had not seemed to note how much strain she was under.
"I didn't realize we took tax records, too," she said, attempting to distract herself and him with questions about routine.
"Always in border sectors, almost never in the interior. We take a duplicate of what they're supposed to give the taxmen when they come next spring. This way, if some disaster should destroy their records, they have at least a partial reckoning on file."
"It's to their advantage, since if there's a disaster of that magnitude, the village may have lost quite a bit more than the records, and the Queen will be able to judge what aid to give them based on what would have been taxed."
She did not make the same mistake with the tea this night, but instead lay in the darkness of the station, staring up at the blackness above her head, listening to Chris's quiet breathing and going back to her earliest lessons in shield discipline. She thought, when she finally was weary enough to sleep, that she might have reinforced her shields enough to carry her through the final day. The fourth day they went over the clerk storyteller's accounts of what they'd told him, making corrections or elaborations as required. When the fifth day dawned, much to Talia's relief, they were back on the road again, headed through the village on their way out, but not to do more than pick up their laundry and visit the village bathhouse. By the time they were well past the village and out into the wilds, it was growing noticeably colder, and both of them were wearing their heavier winter cloaks. The trees were now totally barren of leaves, and the warm, friendly scents of autumn were gone from the wind. Although it seldom rained anymore, the skies continued to be overcast, a featureless slate gray. They crunched their way through a carpet of dead brown leaves that had collected on the roadway. Most of the birds and beasts were gone, hibernating or in hiding now. The loss of foliage and cover made them cautious and quiet, those that were left. The herald seldom saw more than the occasional rabbit or squirrel, and never heard much besides the wind in the naked boughs of the trees and the scream of a crow or two. The companion's bridle bells made a lonely chime against the silence of the sleeping forest. So far as Talia was concerned, that was all to the good. At least she wasn't having to be continually on guard against her shields failing. But her nerves continued to fray, and as they traveled onward through the bleak woods, she wasn't sure which was worse, being alone in this gloom-ridden wilderness, where the gray and empty forest only fed her depression, or being surrounded by people with shields slowly going to pieces. Chris wasn't much happier. He kept wondering if and how much of his general feelings of approval toward Talia were manufactured. Was she consciously or unconsciously augmenting them? He was beginning to examine every nuance of feeling, trying to detect if she had had a hand in it. He liked her, Bright Havens. He wanted to like her. She was so much like him in so many ways. She was a good partner, taking on tasks without complaining, without needing to be prompted, striving to be a full equal and pull her own weight. And yet there were those rumors, and his own feelings that he could well have been tampered with without his ever noticing it. No smoke without fire? Perhaps. It was so damned hard to tell, and the way she was withdrawing wasn't helping. The next stop was 2 days distant, which meant an overnight stay in a way station midway between the two villages. Chris was no longer even thinking of his partner in terms of being female. Now the strain on his nerves was because of his suspicions. They repeated their routine of the first night, Talia readying the shelter, while Chris took care of the four-footed members of the party. His night vision was much better than hers, it only seemed logical, and it gave him a chance to consult with Tantris without her around. Tantris was puzzled and worried.
"I haven't felt anything, little brother, but...
Chris asked aloud.
"I am not certain that I would. Roland is disturbed and refuses to discuss it."
"Great!
He is senior to me, as you are senior to Talia.
If he does not wish to discuss the private affairs of his chosen, that is his business and his right.
I know, I know. Look, at least tell me if you pick up anything, all right?
You have my word, his companion replied. But I think perhaps...
Perhaps what? You need more expert aid,
came the reluctant reply.
Tell me from where, and I'll get it. There isn't anybody in the circle with a gift like hers, and I rather doubt that healer's empathy is identical.
True, came the sigh in his mind. And after that he could coax nothing more out of Tantris on the subject. It troubled him deeply. If a companion didn't feel up to the problem...
And they did not even have time to reach the gate of the next village before they were met on the road by two different parties demanding justice. They saw it coming easily enough.
Steady,
Chris said as they rode into a press of farmers in heavy brown homespun, who crowded up against the sides of the companions with their petitions. Talia went pale and strained, and sat Roland's back absolutely motionless and with lips tightly compressed. Chris did his best to sort out the arguments, then finally lost patience and sharply ordered them all to hold their tongues. When the clamor died down, he finally managed to ascertain that there were two aggrieved parties, both as alike to his eyes as a pair of crows, brown hair, thick brown beards, nearly identical clothing of brown homespun. After listening to both sides and putting up with each one interrupting the other until he was ready to take a stick to both of them, he decreed that the argument was moot until third parties could be questioned. The dispute was a trivial one by his lights, over a cow and her calf. The facts were that a bull had somehow made its way into a field containing a cow in season. Not surprisingly, the calf resulted. The calf was quite plainly the offspring of the bull in question, nor did the cow's owner deny this. What was under dispute was how the bull had gotten at the cow in the first place. The cow's owner claimed angrily that the owner of the bull had allowed it to stray, and that it had found its own way there, and thus he had incurred no stud fee. He pointed to the damage done to his hedges, and inquired with self-righteous wrath if anyone thought he'd ruin his own enclosure to save himself the fee. The bull's owner claimed just as vociferously that the owner of the cow had enticed the bull into the pasture with the express purpose of saving himself the stud fee. Chris felt absolutely helpless. This was not an area in which he had any expertise at all. He glanced entreatingly at his internee, who was farm-bred after all and should have some notion of how to sort it out. Talia was looking a bit white around the lips and eyes, but otherwise seemed in control. He nudged Tantris up beside her and whispered,
"All right, trainee, you know more about this sort of thing than I do. Got any ideas?"
She started just a little. Possibly only someone watching for reactions would have noticed it.
I think so, she said slowly. It's like a dispute we had once back at Sense Holden.
Then take over. I'm out of my depth.
She asked a few questions of the disputants, then went among the rest of the villagers, making inquiries into the habits of each of the parties in question. It was generally agreed that, while the owner of the cow was parsimonious, he was far too stingy to have ruined his own fences just to save a stud fee, and the bull's owner had a habit of allowing it to stray, being too lazy to fix breaks in his own enclosures until after the beast had escaped yet another time. But then she surprised Chris by asking a source he never would have considered, some of the children gathered at the edge of the crowd. After sidelong glances to be certain that no one was likely to tell them to hold their tongues, they told Talia that this particular cow was never kept in the field, where the bull had supposedly found her. She was quite valuable, and her owner always kept her where he could keep an eye on her. Talia returned to the disputants.
"This is my first judgment," she said slowly, and with an oddly expressionless tone. "There is no doubt that your bull did stray, and since it is quite probable that it did the damage claimed to the fences, you owe this man for the repairs he had to make."
The owner of the bull looked extremely disgruntled. The cow's owner gloated.
Talia did not allow him to gloat for long.
You, on the other hand, she told him, not quite looking at him, have never kept your cow in that particular field. You must have seen that the bull had broken in, and decided that since the damage was already done, you might as well save yourself the stud fee. So you moved your cow to the field where the bull was. Because of this,